Mike Matesino is back in studio with us today talking about what I think could conceivably be labeled as your magnum opus. This is an overwhelming set of music. It's called Superman, the Music, 1978 to 1988, produced by Film Score Monthly. Can I say that? Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
And you're the album producer on this.
Mm-hmm, with Lucas Kendall.
And it's an amazing achievement. I have lots of questions to ask you about the whole set, but talk about it. Talk about the set and the significance of this set.
Well, gosh, I mean, you're right. It is a magnum opus, and so much so that I can't really remember how it actually started. I know that I personally became involved in it in maybe May or June of 2006. So we're talking a year and a half ago. And I think that Lucas Kendall, who runs Film Score Monthly, started doing the great tap dance with Warner Brothers Rhino and DC Comics, maybe 3-4 months even before that. So he's been doing that dance for almost 2 years. So it's nice that we ended up with a magnum opus as a result of that. I think it came up initially as part of wondering what had happened to the two-disc Rhino edition that Nick Redman and I produced, which came out in 2000, which did very well but seemed to have disappeared. And without boring all of your listeners with the inner workings of music branches of studios, et cetera, blah, 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 Rhino's involvement in soundtrack releases has kind of dissipated and they've focused on other things. And so the catalog on certain titles seems to be up in the air. With certain ones, they're readily available, but Superman seemed to have kind of drifted off, and nobody knew why. And I thought that it was ludicrous for that thing to not be in print. It's one of the most well-known, highly regarded, hummable scores that's ever been written. And Lucas asked me what the story was with that, and I said, I didn't really know, so why don't you look into it? But Warner Brothers was gearing up for this year of Superman in 2006, where they had Superman Returns coming out, all of the other films and various other incarnations
right,
of
and that
the character.
Big, and that other big Warner's magnum opus. Right,
right with its 14-disc DVD yeah. set, and then, you know, releases of things like the Columbia serials from the 40s, and
right.
a lot of Adventures of Superman and Smallville,
right,
and
of
Lois
course.
And Clark. So this
Time
real
for,
tidal wave.
For Superman Returns,
and then, of course, the Superman II Richard Donner cut DVD. So all of these events. So I think it originally we thought we might be part of that. But then starting as late as we did, we quickly realized that it was a pipe dream to join that party. And in retrospect, I think that it might be a little bit better off that we didn't get lost in all of that, that it did take as long as it did, as much work as we all put into it. But now we are sort of coming up with this almost when it's least expected. And it's a lot of fantastic film music that really needs to be out there, and it finally is.
Yeah, it is. It's incredible listening. But one of my senior staff members who couldn't be here today and who is an authority on the Superman films, he listened to every note of each CD in this set. He read the liner notes religiously, and he even pored over the new Alien CD set you produced, which you were on a little while back about, and she talked about that. His assessment was that these are extremely important releases. The complete scores are absolutely outstanding and magnificent, and that the liner notes in particular and the comprehensive presentation rank among the very best film score albums ever released, past or present. Just thought you'd like to know that.
And just so everybody knows what we're talking about, if he, this colleague, that's about, what, 11 hours of music, I think, and 160-page the hardbound book that goes into this slipcase with the 8 CDs.
It's definitely a desert island disc because you would need that much time to go through it. But it's all rewarding. It's 8 discs, as we said, and it's the first time the complete original soundtrack for all 4 films have been remixed and remastered from the best available source elements. Is
That's
that
correct.
Accurate to say?
That's correct. It varied because I mentioned that, you know, the first Superman, the John Williams Superman from 1978, has been out in a number of incarnations. Superman 2 and 3 were only out on very short albums, LPs at the time that the films were released in the 80s. which were then put together for a very hard to find and now out of print Japanese CD, and then Superman 4, which has never had a score release of any kind. So,
which you're going to be coming back later to talk about that.
About in Superman 4. Superman, yeah, because 4, that really became my baby. So that was very important to me, and I would like to talk about that more.
Well, you mentioned that the Superman score was one of the most, I think you said, tuneful, memorable scores. And what struck me in re-listening again to it, how many themes there are in the score. There's at least 8 or 9 that I can think of.
No, fewer than 9, I think.
Yeah, it has themes. But most film scores, would it be accurate to say most, many, have maybe 3 or 4 themes?
Perhaps now in 2007, you're lucky if you have one.
You're lucky if you have
because,
one.
Because, I mean, producers tend to want to go completely away from that. We get probably more minutes of music in an average movie than we used to.
Yeah.
But it becomes like wallpaper. Williams, I think, knew, genius that he is tapping into an American myth. How do you take an established American myth that was as old as he is and come up with a musical identification for it? And it was the perfect project for him to tap into his absolute encyclopedic knowledge of classical structure and combine that with his ability to use the 20th century conventions, which were brought to modern orchestral music as well as to jazz, Broadway, things like that, make them all work together and come up with something that is classic, timeless, and yet still modern.
I think you said in, this is a quote from the notes, Superman the movie sparkled with modern technology yet breathed with the epic scope of old Hollywood. And I think that's a really good description of this score. There's aspects of it that even now sound a little modernistic, but yet you think of Korngold sometimes, and when you're listening to this, you think of Copland, you think of, as you said, a lot of the classical composers, but also some of the other film composers. You hear Stravinsky in this score. You hear
Strauss.
Yeah. Holst.
Mm-hmm. But yet it still comes through absolutely identifiable as John Williams.
And as a very original work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But again, it's that he did that with Star Wars also. He wrote something that was almost music for a story that had been told over and over and over and that always existed. That's a very hard thing to do. You can't do it consciously.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of reacting to the film that's shown to you. And you understand that when films are shown to composers, they look nothing like they will look to you and I going to see them in the theaters. They might even be in black and white and have marks all over them and the sound isn't complete. But, you know, that's something that's probably never talked about. We speak about a composer's ability to write music, but a film composer has to sit and imagine, looking at a work print usually, how this is really going to play when it's all done, and then think about how music can fit into all of that. But Williams obviously knew the task was to, as I said, tap into a myth here. And it didn't deserve anything less. So in a lot of it, it's the Superman music, its heart is on its sleeve. But if you look a little bit more closely to it, it's incredibly complex and intelligent. And the text for the book and this project was a collaborative effort between myself, Lucas Kendall, and Jeff Eldridge, who's in the Seattle area. Jeff has an authoritative knowledge of John Williams's career, and he's a musician himself. And one of the things that he wrote in the book, which I thought was brilliant, was that Williams has the ability to reach the most and least sophisticated of minds at the same time. So that for those of us who really understand exactly how music works and can listen to something over and over and explore it, there's something there for us. But also to the casual viewer who may just have a movie on in the background, the music will still come through and you bring about a reaction.
The Superman theme, I think another great element in this score is that Williams arguably manages to supplant. To me, Superman was always the George Reeves TV theme, which is, I guess, attributed to Leonard Klatskin, but it's arguable whether he actually composed that or not.
Right. There was no name on The original manuscript was can't be found on that, so we don't. It's but he wrote episodes of the series.
But it's a great theme. It's a great thing, and to come along, what 15 years after that, maybe, and then to create something that now I think most people, when you say Superman, they automatically think of the Williams theme.
Right. It was actually 26 years after 26. That when the movie came out. But the odd thing is that Williams, in the interview he did for Warner Brothers, which we were able to excerpt for this book, he claims to have done no research. Yet there are melodic components of his Superman theme that are also held in common with the TV series theme, and even before that, with the theme for the Fleischer cartoons of the early 40s.
Yeah, I somehow can't believe he'd never heard those.
It is hard to imagine that, but it's possible. But the thing that, to me, stands out as in common is that sense of applying the word Superman to it as if it were a lyric, because all three of those themes have that component in common, but it's those intricate little sophisticated harmonies that Williams has put onto his music that makes it stand out and not seem maybe quite as trite as it would be as if he just played it in kind of a marching band sort of arrangement. But he puts his own stamp on it, but doesn't turn it into something that it shouldn't be.
And he never really considered it the theme a march per se, right?
No, he didn't consider it a march. He wanted it to have a forward movement and an American character, and I guess that tempo just lent itself to that. And I think maybe because in the aftermath of the success of the first Superman, marching bands did start playing it, and you would hear it at parades and football games, that somebody after the fact realized, hey, we can march to this. But I don't think that you're thinking of a march when you're watching the incredible main title sequence from that picture, which still blows me away. You know, as you're listening to that music and going through all this incredible cosmic imagery, and these blue credits are whooshing over you.
We're talking to Mike Matesino, album producer of Superman the Music, 1978 to 1988, on the Film Score Monthly label. 8 discs, 160-page booklet, and lots of time it takes to get through this, but it's very rewarding. How did Williams himself regard this score?
I think he saw it as an incredible opportunity to musically identify a character that had been around and well-known for decades around the world.
But I mean, how did he, maybe he never expressed opinions on his own music, but I'm curious if he thought it was good work.
At the time, I think he just focused on what a great opportunity it was, and that the movie was done with such, to use Richard Donner's term, verisimilitude, and it had an incredible scope and breadth to it. And you could come up with music to comment on the political goings-on of an alien culture, and then score scenes of a young boy being raised in middle America, and then do this cosmopolitan modern-day setting, and then some great adventure chasing missiles and earthquakes in California, etc. I mean, how could you argue with that opportunity? You can almost do anything you want and face the challenge of making it all mesh as one complete score. So I think he saw it as an amazing opportunity, and on the heels of Star Wars, to continue his relationship with the London Symphony Orchestra and all these masterful players. So as a musician, it just was, what more could you ask for? And, you know, and right after that, he went into the second Star Wars film. So he had to have known that he was at the top of his game. And he stayed there since then.
Let's talk a little bit about the scores for Superman 2 and 3. Williams is sort of, curiously absent in terms of credits. Ken Thorne was involved with 2 and 3. Can you talk about that and how that happened?
It basically had to do with Williams taking over the Boston Pops in early 1980. He did initially agree to do Superman 2, but was not going to be available until the fall of 1980 when he was back in London. But he had a meeting with Richard Lester, who took over the completion of Superman II, which had been partially shot under Richard Donner. Then Donner was fired. Richard Lester comes in, finishes the scenes, and changes a few other things around. As the executive producer, Ilya Salkin, tells the story, Williams did not see eye to eye with Lester and didn't want to work with him. And Lester then turned to Ken Thorne, who he'd had a relationship with for 15 years since bringing on board to do Help in the 1960s and a bunch of other of his films that he did, Juggernaut and so forth. But it was really Lester who said, you know, I don't want to stray from the Williams music, so can you adapt it? And Ken Thorne is very, very gifted at adaptation because that's what he did with the Beatles melodies on Help. So he just saw it as that, well, now it's John Williams. And so he read the score. He looked at the film. He figured out what music Williams wrote might work for this scene or that scene, and did the necessary tweaking of timings and had a reduced orchestration, and came up with something that really stood side by side with the first film.
So is it accurate to say that Ken Thorne took music that was composed by John Williams and reassembled it into a different score?
I think he reconstituted it so that it sounded like...
Because it sounds like John Williams.
Yeah. You know, everybody knew that Superman II, despite the change of director, was a companion piece. It was a continuation of the storyline. The main plot of Superman II was set up at the very beginning of Superman I with the three Kryptonian villains being banished to the Phantom Zone, now escaping. A continuation of the relationship between Superman and Lois Lane and figuring all of that out. So that was kind of a mandate, was to stick to that music. But I found it remarkable in examining it very, very closely as to how well chosen some of the cues were, so that they ended up being as effective in the new scenes as they were for the scenes they were originally written for. And sometimes he chose a cue that would remind you of the scene you originally heard it from, and it helped to just add some wonderful layers and depth to the action that was going on. My favorite example of that is in a cue that's called Superman Flies Off, which, if you remember the film, there's this big battle in Metropolis. Superman gets caught in a collision when two of the villains hurl a bus, and then the citizens of Metropolis take it upon themselves to pick up some clubs and whatever and go after the villains, who then start attacking them with super breath, and the whole entire street is reduced to debris and flying cars. And then in the midst of all that, Superman finally emerges from the wreckage. And I think what Ken did there was absolutely brilliant. He takes what we come to consider the personal theme for Superman, and he makes it dark. And then to that, he adds this little phrase that you only hear in the first Superman at the very, very beginning over the comic book prologue, and he combines those two things together. So you can't simply say that he just regurgitated cues without seriously thinking about what raw material was there. Because while still, you know, honoring Williams's contribution, he came up with something new to do with it that Williams could be proud of to hear. And so when you listen to that music and you watch it with the scene, it just works perfectly. It's new. It's by somebody else, yet it honors the original music that it came from. So that's, I think, my favorite example of that.
Let's listen to a sample of that.
Thank you.
Boy, that's terrific music. 79 minutes of music. Superman 2.
We just made it. We actually even toyed with the idea of maybe having to throw one or two cues to the bonus disc, but we just squeezed it in there.
What was also surprising to me, too, Superman 3, we're going to talk a little bit about here. That has some, it's an odd film, but it has some really excellent music, and we've never heard it before, as it never appeared on the soundtrack album that was issued, correct?
Right. There was only, that was in the days in 1983. This would have been when it was very much in vogue to load up your soundtrack album mostly with songs, if not entirely. So how that affected Superman 3 was one side was the background score, maybe 17 minutes worth. The other side was songs that you hear maybe for 5 seconds on a radio station or something in the movie like that, car radio.
I think in the notes it says that Ken Thorne was given more of a free hand on Superman 3. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think the movie was obviously going in a very different direction.
Yeah, weren't there mechanical penguins in the credit sequence or something?
Yes, there was a whole, it opened with a slapstick sequence, and then, of course, you had Richard Pryor in it. You dealt with a supercomputer. So you went a little bit away from the mythological elements that make up the Superman saga. And it just made sense to have the music go in a slightly different direction also. But Ken wanted some continuity, so he did decide himself to retain the Williams-based music for certain key sequences and did have a free hand in exploring some of his own compositional style and came up with some dynamite action music and some dynamite comedy music, but somehow he made it all work. But for things like the factory fire at the beginning and for the what is very rather iconic in that film, which is the Superman's battle with himself, he returns to the, very properly so, returns to the Williams-based music with great effectiveness.
The liner notes that you guys, the three of you, wrote for the set are incredible, if I haven't already emphasized that enough, but I think they rank among the best for any soundtrack album, past or present, as far as just being comprehensive and informative and authoritative, as well as just generally interesting. How on earth did you keep all that material straight?
I wish I remembered, because we have looked at so many versions of this over maybe now 7 or 8 months since it was written, and we saw the first mock-up of what this book was going to look like. We had the benefit, because of a lot of the DVD activity, particularly with the Superman 2 Donner version that came out, that the filmmakers were very available, and I was able to make contact with them and get them directly involved. So there's some fantastic interviews with Ilya Salkind, Tom Mankiewicz, who was the creative consultant, Margot Kidder talking about recording her lyrics for the flying sequence in the first film. So people were very available. So they're all incorporated into the book. The only other one that's of any length that's we're going to do something with is Ken Thorne's full interview, which covers his whole career, which will come out in the Film Score Monthly online magazine. It will be published in its entirety. And it was a matter of collating all of this material in, and I think I did a draft, and then Lucas made some other suggestions, rewrote some things, and we just went back and forth. Jeff made contributions, and it was a matter of just, once it got going, we just kept digging into the research and eventually, like a sculpture, just started shaping itself into something. But eventually it comes together. And I think that 16 was the final number of the proof that we finally then sent to the studio to look at, because then it had to go to them to look over. And DC Comics has their own rules and regulations about the mentioning of trademarked Superman terminology, et cetera. So it's not a simple thing. You can't just throw it together. So when I think back that we had hoped to get this out in 2006, you know, I really can laugh, because it's, I think we, to do it in 18 months itself was not too bad.
What struck me, I think, the most in listening to most of the music, I'll say, on all 8 discs, is how listenable it was. I just assumed that after maybe disc four or something, I would start to get tired of it. And actually, I wanted to hear more. And even the disc eight, where you have all these extra alternative takes, source music, things like that, that have never been released before. Is that correct?
Most of it.
So I guess what I want to ask you is, how, when you determine the listenability of a movie score, some albums aren't easily listened to because there's a lot of little snippets and 30-second cues here and there and everything. But this is something altogether differently. It's very easy to listen to this.
Well, I've spoken before about the various labels who put these kind of scores out and how we all have, over recent years, defined what this market is. And it's actually very simple when it comes to the people who are really passionate about film scores. They want the scores in their entirety presented chronologically, beginning to end of the story, as the composers intended them. So we always strive to do that. Now, there's several things that can get in the way of that, but with Superman, we were successful at presenting that. So you have to just trust that that honors both the composer and the listener. And if you can give them that, then you really don't have to do too much. Of course, there's other decisions that have to get made along the way. Do you combine cues together into one track? How was this presented in the past? So on and so forth. But you basically trust that process. And there are songs and source music from these films that has not ever been released. And it just was an opportunity to do so, since we did have 8 discs to work with. We were able to make it all fit. It just went in like it had eyes. It really just came together on its own, and that made us all very happy.
Mike, you mentioned the people that put these things together and their passion and everything. Who are the people who listen to soundtracks of movie music scores? Sometimes I think it's just like a small group of us, and I'm including myself in this, small group of us, maybe about 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people on the planet who care that much to really want this 8-disc Superman collection. I mean, and I know there have been exceptions, like with the Star Wars scores on the sold millions.
Yeah, once in a while you can break through into the general public, whether you can break through to the people who, download Britney Spears on iTunes is another story. But we always want that. We always want to just get one more person to discover the joys of music written for the cinema. And it's just a natural thing if you want to share, what you really love and what gets a reaction out of you, what gets you excited. And for me, I love the whole concept of a symphony orchestra. I just love the whole history of it, how it's put together and all the instruments you have to work with. And really, movies are the medium through which the orchestral music reaches more people than it ever has in history. Whether the average viewer is aware of it is another story. But the fact, even though popular music has gone away from it, it's still always accepted and expected that orchestral music's going to be the score for a film. Yeah, there's exceptions. But by and large, symphony musicians are still in demand for film scores. And those of us who like to listen to it, want to do everything we can to propagate that, to get more scores out there. And it's really the only element that you can separate out from a finished film and present separately. It's like you don't put out a disc of the editing. You don't put out a disc of the special effects. But music is something you can separate out and present on its own. Maybe the screenplay you can publish, but that's really about it. It can stand on its own as its own artistic achievement, yet also still be intrinsic to the overall effectiveness of a movie.
Is it accurate to say that John Williams may be the most, I don't want to say listened to composer? As we were talking here, I just realized, and I think about all the scores he's written. I guess if you look in the top 20 films of all time, maybe he's written maybe what, like 10 of those scores. I think of his music for the Olympics, which are seen by like maybe a billion or two people. They're all hearing it. Would it be accurate to say that the music that he composes is probably heard by more people than anybody else? Any other composer?
I think it would be fair to say that. A composer of orchestral music. He's certainly the only living person who can conduct an entire concert program of his own music exclusively and have it all be recognized. People may not realize that certain things are him. When NBC Nightly News signs off at night, you're listening to John Williams.
Right.
He wrote a theme for the NFL.
You know, that's a great distinction in any day and age, but in this particular time, it's even more staggering.
It's astounding
when you think,
and then don't forget that every time something gets used, a composer gets paid. So if you think of Jaws, Star Wars, the five notes from Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Superman, Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., the Olympics, NBC, Home Alone, Schindler's List, Harry Potter. I mean, it's astounding. It's just astounding that this all came from one gentleman.
Superman the Music, 1978-1988, new 8-disc collection of Superman music, and it's fabulous. We've been talking to album producer Michael Matesino. How can people get this recording?
Go to filmscoremonthly.com, which is the website for Filmscore Monthly magazine. You can subscribe to the online magazine there. You can link there to the catalog of all of their releases through Screen Archives Entertainment, which is their distributor, as well as hundreds of albums by all of our favorite composers and just a ton of film music. It's a great resource. That's the place to go.
Mike Matesino, formerly Michael Matesino, movie music CD soundtrack preservationist. You're sort of a restoration expert too, kind of? Sort of, yeah, aren't you?
I would classify myself as that, sure. Yeah. I do that more than producing.
I get this image of you in a room alone with headphones on for like hours on end listening to tapes. Well, I don't know if tapes now, but whatever, digital, whatever. Over and over and over and over and over and over and over again.
That's very accurate. I would say that's very accurate because I have dealt with quite a lot of material that's of some vintage. And God bless the people who are on the cutting edge of this technology, not only like the digital editing Pro Tools and all of that, but just the mechanics of transferring old tapes and preserving the old tapes, because sometimes you open a can and what you find inside is vinegar.
Right.
But, you know, I've done a lot of work with Nick Redman, who has spearheaded this whole restoration effort at 20th Century Fox.
He's done some great work for
them. And we are in the process still of mining the archive there. And there were actually things that 10 years ago we couldn't even physically play that, believe it or not, now we can actually get something out of. So then once you can get an old tape to actually play and get a digital recording of it, I can then work with it and even do more with it. And something goes from not existing to existing better than it ever sounded before. So I love that process. And I will, on some projects where it's called for, go out and paint out ticks and pops and noises one by one to get something listenable. You know, I mean, a record company's reputation, you know, depends on this. And so it's my job to make sure that they shine and that we keep this going so that maybe other studios will say, hey, you know, this studio did that and it sounded great. And we've got some stuff too that we could get out. That's what we always want. We want to get more and more and more. This is our history. This is our cultural and musical history.
And where do you do the work? Do you have to go, if you're dealing with sensitive elements, do you have to go to the studios to do this? Can you work from an office away from the studios?
I generally work away from the studios in my own little studio. But it all depends on what the source material is. So in the case of Superman, the elements had already been transferred by the Warner Sound Department. So I simply had to go over to Warner Brothers with my hard drive and they copied the elements onto it. Simple. If it's of a manageable element like a quarter-inch tape or a digital format like a DAT tape or something, they'll give it to me directly and I'll transfer that. I have the facility for that. If it's a some other element like an old optical tape or maybe a 2-inch multi-track tape, it will go to one of the big sound houses that a particular studio uses and they'll transfer it. And again, then I'll go over with a hard drive. So getting it into the digital format is basically happens before I get to it. But I get exactly what's on the tape. Turning it into something else is a whole other process.
Mike Matesino, album producer, Superman the Music, 1978 to 1988, the 8-disc set, 160-page booklet, available from Film Score Monthly. We're going to have you back to talk about Superman 4, which is a whole other story in itself, but I'm looking forward to that. So we'll talk to you then, Mike. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
And I'm Tim Sika for Celluloid Dreams, 90.5 FM KSJS San Jose, and online at celluloiddreams.net. To hear an expanded version of our interview with Mike Matesino, check out our website at celluloiddreams.net. And for more information on Superman the Music, 1978 to 1988, go to filmscoremonthly.com. That's filmscoremonthly.com.